Hello, 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 fellow pushers. Welcome to another episode of Pushing Cardboard. I'm your host, Grant Lindeberg, and this is episode 30, General Orders and Rebel Fury. No interview this month, but I'll take a look at two recent games. General Orders World War II is from the dynamic duo of David Thompson and Trevor Benjamin. It lives in a niche almost all its own. It's a war game that's also a worker placement game. I know, strange, but it'll be cool. Rebel Fury from Mark Herman is the distillation of a system that Mark had first debuted in C3I magazine. I'll take a dive into each of these games and let you know how they work, what I like about them. If you haven't registered for the website, what are you waiting for? It's free, you rarely get an email from me, but it gives you access to the forums and the members-only polls, the latest of which allows you to pick a game or vote to pick a game for a dive in our May podcast. So come register for the website. Thank you to those who took a minute to complete the after-episode survey on last episode. It's really helping me shape the content of the podcast, though the divide between the folks who want more interviews and the folks who want no interviews is not going to be resolved anytime soon. And finally, thank you to those who have recently chipped in to support the channel. Tom Woloshin, Dave Blizzard, Steve Carey, Michael Sundborg, and David Siskin, I thank you for your support. And thanks to those of you who came out to the first ever Pushing Cardboard live stream. I'd done a few live streams before, but always as part of someone's convention. This was my first on my own, and I'm not quite sure what to make of it. We only had 6 or 7 people watching live, which made me think maybe it wasn't such a great idea. But then by the next day, there were 150 views of the archived video. So obviously a lot of people were interested, but couldn't watch it live. So overall, I thought maybe there's enough interest to try it again down the road sometime, maybe even make it a regular thing. Let me know what you think. As soon as this episode is edited and uploaded, I'll be hitting the road. Another one of my epic drives down to Hanford, California to go to the GMT weekend at the warehouse. I'm sure I'll manage to grab an interview or two, and I'll report back on any demos I see or announcements of new games. I'm looking forward to it. News. Harold and the gang at San Diego HistCon are hosting another online convention on Saturday, June 8th. It starts early in the morning European time and finishes at night Pacific time. There's tons of interviews, demos, panels, and $10 gets you access to the whole shebang. As always, for items in the news section, you can find a link to this in the newsletter or in the show notes. Salt and Pepper Games have announced a crowdfunding campaign for their new game, Operation Barkley. It's not exactly a war game. It's about the intelligence war between the Allies and the Germans in 1942-43. Low complexity. Salt and Pepper is the same folks who brought us Resist and The Hunt, so it's worth checking out. Also not a war game, but from one of our favorite publishers, $10 Words is from Amabel Holland and Hollenspiel. It's never a bad idea to check out what Amabel has been up to. Thin Red Lines have done something a bit unusual. Their three games, 1985 Under an Iron Sky, 1985 Deadly Northern Lights, and 1985 Sacred Oil, are all out of print. But they've put together a Vassal module that includes them all, and they encourage you to try it out. They've put up a page with new rules to link the three, as well as links to download the Vassal module and its extensions. Well, this must be the month of non-warm games, because here's another one. Dever Games have announced Sand, a post-apocalyptic game where players travel vast deserts carrying their goods on the backs of giant caterpillars. I know, sounds a bit like Dune, but the Dever folks swear it's just a coincidence, so go check it out. Armageddon Wars by Flying Pig Games is being reprinted. It's been out of print for a while, so now's your chance to get it if you'd always wanted it. And Worthington have announced a different sort of project. It's a game that's published as a book. It's called B-17 Solitaire, and it's available through Amazon rather than directly from Worthington. And that's about it for news this month. After having 2 GMT newsletters to get through last month, I'm apparently getting the podcast out before the next one drops, so lucky me. What's on the table? This month I want to talk not so much about the exact scenario as the excellent Vassal module we're using. The game is Commands and Colors Napoleon. I play with Mark Benson, the designer of the current Vassal module, and also the wrangler of all the GMT Vassal modules. I started playing with Mark when he took over development of the module, as he only played CCN live over Vassal, and he wanted some insights from a PBM player. I generally help him playtest new releases of the module. It's not a big deal, but we've identified a few things that needed to be changed for PBM play. That said, you really need to check out this module. It sets a new standard in Vassal automation. It's aware of what card you played, and it will notify you if you move a unit incorrectly. It calculates the number of dice to be rolled on a battle and indicates retreats. It takes into account terrain when making those calculations. It knows your unit capabilities. And at the end of the turn, it knows whether you draw just a command card or also a tactic card, and knows when to do the special draw two, choose one routine for a scouting card. Very impressive. Mark has also taken full advantage of the help menu as well. Whereas so many Vassal modules have nothing in this menu beyond the generic Vassal guide, there's a lot of support here in Mark's module, not just for the module itself, but for CCN in general. And most helpful to new users, there's a manual for the module and also a tutorial. Highly recommended. New games to the collection. A relatively light month this time. The latest issue of C3 magazine finally arrived. I think I was on the end of the mailing list for this one, as I didn't get my copy until I'd seen tons of coverage on it on Twitter and Board Game Geek. I was very jealous for a while there. It's a jumbo issue. I think there's four games in there. I've only messed around with the main game, Beta's Campaign, which is a new twist on Mark Herman's Gettysburg system, transported to an ancient setting. And then I bought a couple of used games. Eagles of the Empire Borodino was published in 1994 and comes from a publisher I didn't know of called Games USA. And I got the updated version of Napoleon at Bay published by Operational Studies Group. And then finally, VUCA sent me a copy of Red Strike, their giant box of Cold War Gone Hot gaming. It's quite the package. It's got 23 counter sheets. I encourage you to check out my my unboxing on YouTube about it. You'll hear more about this in a future podcast, I'm sure. I'm hoping to play a bit of it at GMT West. Newbie tips. Let's talk about storage. Many war games you buy come with a few Ziploc baggies to store the pieces in, and for smaller games they work just fine. But for larger games you may decide you want a better storage system, so welcome to the world of counter trays and Plano boxes. Up front, here's a key tip to keep in mind. The best storage systems facilitate quick setup and teardown. That doesn't always mean sorting the pieces by unit type. In games where there's a steady stream of units entering the game, it can be much better to sort the pieces into a group that starts on board, and then the rest into groups sorted by turn of entry. This makes setup much, much quicker. In games with many scenarios, if each scenario has its own pieces, then sort by scenario. But more usually the pieces will be shared across all the scenarios, and this is when you need to sort by unit type. My only tip here is if you end up needing more than one counter tray, put all the game markers in one tray and all the unit pieces in another, or one or two, whatever it takes. That way you can keep the markers handy while playing. Once you start using trays, the downside can be that they don't totally fit back into the game box. I mean, they fit, but the lid doesn't close totally. That will lead you out to, figuring out the least amount of tray possible. GMT trays are cheap and they work well, but they only come in one size. A new company in Poland called Cube for Me makes a variety of sizes, including a variety of depths. When space is an issue, these trays pack more into limited space than the GMT trays. I'll put a link in the notes so you can check them out. The shipping wasn't all that much either. For really big games like Advanced Squad Leader, you'll want to investigate Plano storage boxes. These are essentially configurable tackle boxes, but they're great for ASL. You can generally fit one nationality and all its vehicles per box. Plano 3701 is my favorite. You can find them at hardware stores, fishing stores, wherever you get your tackle stuff for fishing. They also, I guess they're in hardware stores as well because they're great for sorting screws or hardware, stuff like that. One final note though, going back to my imperative about using your storage system to facilitate quicker setup and teardown, I used to use Plano boxes for all my Commands and Colors games, each different unit type in its own little space. But I found setup and pack up to be time consuming and fiddly. So I went back to just putting each side's pieces in a big Ziploc. Setup is only marginally slower, but pack-up is super fast, as you can imagine. I know, if you have a touch of OCD, this may drive you batty, but I tell you, it really works. Okay, time to talk about some games. First up, General Orders by David Thompson and Trevor Benjamin, published by Osprey. This one is a bit of a unicorn. It's not really a history game in that the history it's modeling is fairly generic World War II stuff. It's not an actual battle or campaign, but rather one action that's vaguely in Italy and one action that's definitely on an unnamed island in the Pacific. And it's not a traditional war game in any sense. It's more like a worker placement game. There's a bit of combat, but it takes a backseat to where you place your units. So, with that giant caveat out of the mind, out of the way, I should say, and as a warning to the old school Hex Encounter crowd, I've got to say it's a lot of fun. A real little brain burner. Oh, one more thing that makes it so unusual. It's packaging. It comes in a really small box. It's 4.5 by 6 by 3 inches. So not a shape or a size or shape that we're accustomed to on the wargaming shelves. It's fantastic to see something that hasn't been totally overpackaged just to take up more shelf space at the store. This is great. It fits in that small box because the components are minimal. There are two scenarios, but the small mounted map is double-sided. It folds into four, so unfolded it's roughly 9 by 12. The playing pieces are wooden bits. Discs for infantry units, hexagonal cylinders for commanders, and little wooden airplanes for the Pacific scenario. There are half a dozen little cardboard chits for random goodies that are placed at setup, and there's a small deck of cards for each side. There's a little sideboard track, and then finally, four custom dice. It all fits easily back into the little box with room to spare. And despite the small size, there's no worries about it not fitting back into the box once you punch the counters. It doesn't sort of grow once you've punched it out. Setup is a breeze. You choose which scenario to play and set out the map. The map shows you where to deploy your initial forces, and the rest of your infantry or air units go in front of you in your reserve area. Each side gets five commanders in their reserve. Those are the hexagonal cylinders, and the rest are tucked away by the turn track. Depending on which scenario you're playing, you'll remove a handful of unneeded cards from each deck, shuffle the remainder to form draw decks, and you're ready to start. The first player of the first turn is determined randomly, and then each turn thereafter it'll depend on placement of commanders. Each scenario is just four turns long. On each turn, each player will deploy their five commanders, which will initiate certain actions. Through card play, it's also possible to get extra commanders to give yourself more actions. The map boards are familiar hex grids, large hexes, but the hexes aren't quite like normal hexes. Some areas are a single hex, some are two joined hexes, and some are three joined hexes. It's critical to understand this. These are one, two, or three hex land areas. When I was initially learning the game, I missed that. I was thinking of each hex as a distinct area, but no. It's more like an area map where the hexes are based on, where the areas are based on hexes. I should also note that the mountain map board and its order of battle is completely symmetrical. Both sides have the same starting units and map areas, whereas the Pacific board is asymmetric. The invading US forces have an advantage in air power and manpower, but the defending Japanese have more artillery and start with more control of the map. Certain areas on each map have 1 to 3 pink stars. These are basically victory points. As well, there's an area on each of the maps that is designated as each side's headquarters. Victory conditions are simple. If you capture the enemy HQ, you win immediately. If neither side manages that, then the player controlling the most pink stars is the winner. Each map also has 3 or 4 hexes with slots for the aforementioned random chits. Controlling these areas gives the owner significant bonuses. Perhaps an extra card draw, perhaps extra troops, that sort of thing. They're placed randomly each game, and there's more than enough needed for each scenario, so they're going to provide some randomness to the maps and ratchet up the replayability factor a bit. And then finally, each map area has an icon where you'll place your commander marker when you move in. Some areas will also have icons showing that they're home to artillery, paratroops, or air bases. Okay, so we're set up. How does it work? Well, let's just talk about the mountain scenario for now. Both sides start with about half their troops on board and five commanders. The side that goes first places a commander marker either on board for an onboard action or on the sideboard for a support action. It's not a long list of actions either way. On board, the main action is advance. You place your marker on the advance icon of a land area, and then you can move in troops from any adjacent area. There's a couple things to keep in mind. First, when advancing in, you have to leave at least one troop unit in any area you're advancing from, so no leaving areas vacant. Second, there's a 5-unit stacking limit per area, but note that this 5-unit limit is only enforced after any combat, so you can move in more than 5 in expectation of losses. And finally, you can only advance into a land area that doesn't already have a commander unit on its advance icon. This is where we start to feel the worker placement vibe of the game. If you have a weak area, it can be a smart move to advance in yourself, even just a single unit, if only to deny your opponent the chance to advance in. If the area you advanced into has enemy troops, combat occurs after the move. It's super simple. The defender rolls one of the custom dice. They're six-sided. One face is blank, one face has two hits, and the other four faces have a single hit. So the defender rolls one of these, and that's the number of hits the attacker loses moving in. After that, whoever has the least amount of units left loses all of them, and the other player loses an equal amount. So it's very close to non-random losses. 67% of the time, the attacker will lose one unit up front, and then it's just a one-for-one trade-off. If the attacker moves in with three more units than the defender has, there's no way for the attacker to lose. But there's not a ton of pieces on the board, so you're not going to have the plus three advantage very often. The other two onboard actions in the mount scenario are barrage and paradrop. Barrage lets your artillery unit attack any enemy space up to three land hexes away from your artillery location. The attacker just rolls two dice and the defender takes the losses, no defense. Paradrops let you drop two units from your reserve onto any area on the board other than your opponent's HQ and a couple specifically marked areas that say no paradrops. You can drop into areas that have already been advanced into as well. If you drop into an enemy-occupied area, combat occurs just as if you'd just advanced in. Offboard, there are two different support actions. You can choose to get replacements, which lets you place five or six units from your reserve into spaces you control on the board. Or you can choose the planning action, which nets you either two cards or one card and the guarantee of going first next time. The cards in question are a real key. They give you all sorts of bonuses. Perhaps a card will let you paradrop four units instead of two, or give you two extra units when you reinforce. There's cards that let you roll extra dice on defense, which of course gives the attacker a nasty surprise. There's cards that let your artillery roll four dice instead of two. So you get the idea. Big bonuses. The cards shake the game out of its confines and stretch the rules a bit. Similarly, so do those random chits that are placed on the board at setup. Controlling those give bonuses similar to the cards. So, in a turn, players alternate placing commanders and taking actions until both players are out of commanders. Then the commanders are all picked up off the board, returned to the owners, the turn marker advanced, and you do it all again. Of course, now we have no commanders on board on the advance markers anymore, so all the spots that were blocked through the previous turn are now open to be advanced into, either as an attack or simply to block your opponent from attacking. There's also a fairly simple supply rule. If you have an area that cannot trace a path back to your HQ, it is out of supply. You cannot advance out of such an area. Also, you cannot barrage from such an area. So if you can put your opponent's artillery out of supply, you can shut off those pesky barrages. The Pacific map has all the same actions as the mountain map, but no paradrops. But it also adds in aircraft, giving you new actions. Takeoff lets you bring more aircraft into the game, sort of like reinforcements. Fly is like the air equivalent of advance, and bomb is like the air equivalent of artillery from the air. And instead of the three area range, you can only bomb an adjacent area, but you get one die per bomber. And that's it for mechanics. As I mentioned off the top, it's not much for making you feel like you're recreating any specific battle, but even though it's definitely a worker placement type game, it still does feel a bit like a war game. There's plenty of decisions, and there's a lot of tension between wanting to grab more cards, but the need to advance and needing reinforcements. There's tension between wanting to push forward and wanting to deny your opponent spots to push into. And of course, the cards you get will shape your strategy. You might be the sort of player who likes to hang back and pounce on your opponent's mistakes, but if all your cards are offensive cards giving you combat and movement bonuses, you'd be wasting your time if you didn't shift to an all-out attack. I really enjoyed the cat and mouse of the commander placement in this game. I managed to get my son to play with me. He prefers short games, so I thought this would be right up his alley. He definitely liked how quick it was to learn and play, but he was a little disappointed there wasn't more combat. Perhaps that was just the two of us dancing around each other so much. I was certainly struck by what a perfect game this would make for Rally the Troops or Yukata or Board Game Arena. I don't know if Osprey has any of their games on those online sites, but this would be a great first choice. I totally recommend it. General Orders, World War II by Osprey Games. Okay, game number two is Rebel Fury by Mark Herman, published by GMT Games. This is a very cool idea. It's sort of modeled on the old SPI quads of the 70s. In those games, you'd get four different battles in a single box that all use the same rules. Rebel Fury is the same, but it gives us six battles in this box. The game system here is not totally new. Herman created the original in his Gettysburg game that was originally published in C3I magazine in 2018. He further refined the system with his Waterloo game a year later, again in C3I. Rebel Fury uses the Waterloo system and then just tweaks the combat system a little bit. This may make it sound like some big rule set that just keeps getting overhauled, but it's really the opposite. Herman's goal in the original game was to make a simple playable game, but to do something new rather than yet another cookie-cutter introductory game. And he succeeded in spades, in my opinion. The biggest thing that takes old Grognards a bit to wrap their heads around is that in a turn in this game, every unit can move many times. I move a unit, then you move a unit, then I move a unit, and so on until one of us passes. And we can move the same unit over and over and over. There's a die roll with a few modifiers to see how many moves the other player gets before we have to quit as well. So what makes a unit stop moving? Well, we'll get to that, but let's back up a bit first to describe what it all looks like. The map scale is 1/2 mile per hex. The units are infantry and cavalry divisions. Some large divisions will have two or three counters instead of just one. There's a few smaller detachment counters as well. These cannot move or attack, but can interrupt your opponent's movement. There are also leader headquarter counters, but they don't represent the actual placement of said leader's headquarters, but rather what Herman calls the center of operations, a general idea of where the leader exists and where the action is going to be. Artillery is abstracted out. Each side gets a set number of artillery points per scenario rule that can be expended to increase their odds in combat. The infantry and cavalry units are double-sided. One side is their maneuver mode, where infantry get 4 movement points and cav get 6. On their flip side is battle mode, where they each get just a single movement point. This differentiation between modes, is a key to the game. Units can only stay in maneuver mode while on roads or open ground. Every other terrain types they move into makes them stop and flip to battle mode immediately. They won't get a chance to flip back to maneuver mode until the next turn. While not totally new, another key concept here is that divisions not only exert a zone of control in the 6 immediately adjacent hexes, but also a zone of influence in the 12 hexes that surround those 6 hexes. Which brings us back to what makes a unit stop moving if they have unlimited movement. If you move a division into the zone of influence of an opposing division, you have to stop there and flip to battle mode if your unit is not already in that mode. Then when it's back to you to move another unit, you can move this same unit, but now only a single hex as it's in battle mode. If you move a unit from another unit's zone of influence into its zone of control, you stop, and neither unit can move again this turn. So that's how a unit's movement ends. The movement phase sees each player alternating activating units with any that move adjacent losing their ability to move anymore. At some point, one player will be done moving and pass, and the other player will get a randomly determined number of final moves, and then it's movement over, time for combat. The decision of when to pass is a key one. You may be able to catch your opponent out of position, but Herman has put in a clever rule that says if you pass, your opponent gets to roll a 10-sider, and he gets that amount plus one move for every division that isn't in an opponent's zone of influence or zone of control. So if you pass too early, you're likely going to be giving your opponent a ton of extra moves to work with. Before we leave movement, we also need to talk about leaders. The leaders' HQs are similarly double-sided with maneuver side and a battle side. Each side also has a command radius. The maneuver side will have a large radius of 12 to 15 hexes, depending on the leader, where the battle side will be more compact, maybe 4 to 6 hexes. But the battle side also has the leader's battle stars, a bonus that can be added to any unit's combat in the leader's combat radius. But here's the big catch. Any unit not in its leader's command radius must move towards that leader if and when it moves. There's a tiny exception for units using road movement, but it still makes them close the overall distance to the leader. This is huge. There's no maneuvering with units that are out of command. They either come towards the leader or they don't move. This is brilliant, and it really pays off in the way Herman has designed the initial scenario setups. There's often lots of units out of command. Leaders can only switch mode between turns and move locations between turns. A leader that was in maneuver mode can always move to a new location next turn and choose which new mode to be in, but a leader in battle mode has to roll to be able to move and switch. So you don't take switching to battle mode lightly if you still need to make some big moves with your divisions. After all the moves are done, it's time for combat. The system has grown a wee bit in the three iterations of the system. By the way, if you want to check out the previous two games online, Gettysburg is on Steam, very cheap, and Waterloo is free on Rally the Troops, so check it out there. Anyway, here's the bones of combat. The side with initiative makes the first attack. There's no stacking, and one unit attacks another. There's no linking of units to form a large attack, nothing like that. One unit versus another. The attacker gets 1 point for their attacking unit, and another point if the attacking unit has a battle star, and then another three if they're adding in their artillery. If they're in the command range of their leader and the leader is in battle mode, they'll get 1 point for each of the battle stars on the leader. If there's a friendly unit that is adjacent to both the attacker and defender, they'll get another 2 points. And finally, if there are any units of the same core of the attacker's core, then you get to add one more point. You add them up and you'll have the attacker's battle total. The defender has many of the same points. One for the defender, one more if the defender has a battle star, four more instead of three if using artillery defensively, three to five more for defensive terrain, and then the same leadership bonus. But there's no bonus for having another defending unit adjacent to both the defender and attacker. And then finally, 1 point bonus for being adjacent unit from the same core is there again. So you add them up and you have the defender's battle total. It sounds like a lot, but this becomes very quick when you've done it a couple times. On the player's aid card, there's a chart called Tactical Position Determination. Both the attacker and defender will roll on this chart, cross-indexing their total battle points with their die roll. And there's four possible outcomes: significant advantage, advantage, disadvantage, and significant disadvantage. So the defender and the attacker will each get one of these tactical positions. They may both end up with the same tactical position, who knows. Then we skip down to the attack results table and cross-index the attacker tactical position with the defender tactical position. And here's where we get our variety of results. The attacker or defender could be forced to retreat. The defender could be forced to a counterattack. Attacker or defender can be blown or eliminated. If blown, their counter is removed from the map and placed two turns in advance on the turn track where they will return. If they're eliminated, they're eliminated, and that counts for victory points. There's a little more granularity here as well if the defender is in defensible terrain. There's a custom die that can be rolled, which may make the losing side retreat or be blown. So those are all the outcomes. After that first attack, then the other side chooses an attack. Back and forth, one side, then the other, attack, 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 until one side passes. At that point, the side that still wants to attack rolls a die and gets that many more possible attacks, and then the turn ends. And then that's the end of the turn. You start again. You determine who goes first by who has the most leader battle stars on board. If you're tied, it's a simple roll-off. And you see which leader headquarters you can redeploy. It's like I said earlier, the ones in maneuver mode are easy to redeploy. The ones in battle mode take a roll, probably. After that, there's a couple steps for dealing with detachments, removing them and replacing them. The detachments, they're basically small defensive units. They can be placed and removed. Most scenarios give each side one to three of them. They can't attack, but they have a zone of control, so they can... they can make movement sticky for your opponent. And then finally, the organization phase. This is where any units in battle formation that are not in an enemy unit's ZOI or ZOC can be flipped back to maneuver mode. As well, any blown divisions that are returning are placed here. And then both players get a chance to disengage any units that are in an enemy zone of control by retreating them three hexes and leaving them in battle mode. And then that's it, and it's time for movement and combat again. Victory in Rebel Fury comes in a few flavors. In each battle, both sides are given an overall objective that will be fairly difficult to achieve, but if they do, they will score what's called a strategic victory, the highest level of victory. If neither side manages to achieve their strategic goal, Then it comes down to counting casualties, with the side inflicting the most scoring either a tactical or operational victory, depending on the point spread. And that's it. It's really quick to learn, but deceptively deep. Mark Herman is a lifelong chess player, and I think it seeps into this game. The different opening possibilities for the scenarios, the back-and-forth movement, the blocking and sacrificing, it has a very chess-like feeling in the best possible way. I hesitate to say it's a quick game to play because this chess-like feeling is really going to slow down those players who are prone to analysis paralysis. There's a lot to think about every turn. The components are lovely as you'd expect from GMT. The counters have been changed from their Gettysburg versions. I like the old style better, I think, but I get what they're trying to do here. On the new counters, the infantry units appear to be in march formation on the maneuver side and in line formation on the battle side, so that makes sense. There's also a dedication in the game. The game is dedicated to the artist, the late Rick Barber, who designed the maps and created the playtest maps. Sadly, he died while the game was still in production, so the final maps were done by Charlie Kibler based on Rick's research. They're beautiful. But if you'd heard these were Rick Barber's last maps, you won't be seeing his pen and ink style here, but rather his research and design. There are 6 battles in the box, as I've said, and I've had a go at half them so far, so here's a few quick thoughts. Chickamauga. Long strung-out setup with the leaders at one end and both sides' units strung out all the way across the map. It makes for a thrilling opening as all the strung-out units have to move toward their leaders or not move. This one really falls into that type of game where the opening could be debated for years. Chattanooga. The setup here feels like the proverbial knife fight in a phone booth. The strategic victory is the same for both sides, a line of hexes clear of enemies ZOC, ZOI, linking Chattanooga with Ringgold, which is on the other side of the board edge, on the other side of the map from Chattanooga. I find it hard to imagine the Confederates accomplishing this as they have less units, less leaders, and no heavy artillery. But, you know, who knows? The Union have a couple of broad choices. One is a line straight east through the bulk of the Confederate line, and the other is a more loopy line around the south and then east. The rebels do start with some units over there, but they are all in range of the Union heavy artillery, which gets a bit of a bonus. In my play, the Confederates also suffered a leader casualty, so that made things worse. The Union managed to break through and establish a line, and not having a leader that could add in his battle stars was most likely the Confederate downfall, so my playing was probably not typical. The Wilderness. This is another scenario where the Union really outnumber the Confederates, but the strategic goals are different here. The Union must clear a line across the board from one of their pontoon bridges in the north to an exit hex directly across the board. The kicker here is the line can only be 35 hexes long, and the shortest distance you could possibly do it is 28 hexes, so you don't have much room to make anything but a fairly straight line. The rebels' strategic win is to get adjacent to one of the 3 pontoon bridges in the north, so they have a real dilemma. How many units do they send north to try to get a pontoon, and how many do they leave behind to block the Union? To make things even harder for the Union, this battle is only 4 turns long. There's a good chance that means their leader, Grant, will have to stay in maneuver mode. Well, actually, Lee may need to do the same a bit if the rebs are going to get all the way to the pontoons. A fast, cool scenario. And then Spotsylvania. This is basically a continuation of the Wilderness, but it starts where the Wilderness scenario ends. This is one of the big 2 10-turn scenarios. It's a big sweeping affair where both sides start close to one another on the west side of the map. The Union needs to make it way over to the far east side and keep a line open from Spotsylvania Courthouse in the bottom right to an exit hex in the top right. The Confederates have a similar strategic objective, but their line runs roughly across the center of the map rather than way over on the right side. The catch here is that if both sides achieve their objectives, the rebels win. So the Union has to not only secure their line, but also deny the Confederate line. They do have 26 infantry units compared to the Confederates' 18, so they have the manpower to do it. Confederates have a little special rule where 6 of the Confederate units get to make a special night march at the beginning of the game and stay in maneuver mode for 2 moves no matter what hexes they go through, so they get a little jump on the heading east. Interestingly, even though it's a large battle with many units in 10 turns, each side only gets 14 artillery points and only has 1 leader. Many of the smaller scenarios start with 19 artillery points per side and sometimes more than one leader on a side. So artillery has to be rationed out here, and the first turns will likely have the leaders remain in maneuver mode. I can't say, I haven't played this one yet, only set it up to study it, but man, it is compelling. In the box, there's two more battles included. Fredericksburg is the shortest in the game at just three turns, but the twist here is it includes solo rules. And then using the same map is Chancellorsville, which is another big turn, big 10-turn scenario. Its victory conditions are the harshest in a way. The Union has to keep two separate long lines clear to make its strategic win, and whereas for the Confederates, any tactical or operational win is automatically a strategic win. So all they have to do is deny the Union both lines while scoring a single extra casualty, and they'll get the top prize. When I first received the Gettysburg game in C3I, I almost dismissed it. It looked too simple. But, you know, what the hell, took it for a spin with my son, and it was way more fun than I thought. So then I played a couple more games online via Vassal, and then when Waterloo came out, I played that as well. I liked the small changes there and the addition of the detachments. I confess, I was a little confused by part of the victory conditions there, but I came to understand them. And then once that game appeared on Rally the Troops, well, I've been playing it constantly ever since. So I was really primed to like Rebel Fury, and it hasn't disappointed me. I know it's gonna piss off a few old school diehards who hate the unlimited movement, but you know, that's their loss. It's innovative, and it takes the idea of introductory war game to a much better place. Because sure, the system's easy to teach, but these battles are deep and rewarding. The system is only introductory in that the rules are easy. The gameplay is deep, like chess. So, yeah, I totally recommend it. And I should also note that, GMT did send me a review copy, and I was very glad to receive it. It's everything I thought it would be. Parting shots. Well, playing Rebel Fury has put me in mind of the old days of wargaming. Back in the 70s and 80s, when there were far fewer releases, games were replayed repeatedly, at least the good ones were. Today, there's more of a tendency to play a game once or twice and then move on to the next big thing. But back then, the pages of Avalon Hill's The General magazine and Moves magazine, they were filled with articles on strategy for a wide variety of games. Sure, there'd be articles about the latest release, but there'd also be articles with new approaches to older games. Titles like Africa Corps and the Russian Campaign had dozens of strategy articles written about them over the years. I sort of miss that. Well, I do enjoy the writing being done on the hobby today. Almost none of it is about strategy anymore. It's mostly all reviews or historical background. You know, some great articles to be sure, but I'd love to see some writing about best approaches for certain games or scenarios. And then response articles arguing with said approaches. Current writing shows a lot of width, but not so much depth. I was thinking about this after reading a thread on Board Game Geek on the best opening strategy for the Chickamauga scenario in Rebel Fury. Mark Herman was a participant in that thread and used it as a way to encourage deeper thought about the game. It was exactly what I was looking for. I think Rebel Fury really encourages this sort of analysis, so I'm hoping we see more of it. Writing strategy articles isn't exactly my forte, or I'd try to chip in myself, but you know, if it's your thing, please reach out to me. I'd be happy to post your articles on strategy on pushingcardboard.com. Okay, if you're a fan of the podcast and want to chip in to support the content, I've now got a few new ways to do it. If you like the YouTube stuff, you can become a member of my YouTube channel, or if you're more into the podcast, come to the website and click on the Ko-Fi link, and you can donate that way. And of course, my new sponsor is Noble Knight Games. Noble Knight has helped me track down old issues of S&T magazines that I've always wanted, as well as beautiful copies of used games for titles I missed along the way and always regretted. I'm happy to recommend them. So if you're a Noble Knight user or you want to become one, please enter their site through the links on my site. That way they'll know I sent you. Well, that's it for another episode of Pushing Cardboard. You'll hear from me again in a month when I'll have stories from my trip to GMT West. In the meantime, I'll talk to you on our Discord server or see you at the website. Happy gaming, and talk to you soon.